Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment. What makes us value good behavior and fairness? Is it religion or our necessity for cooperation? Is it innate? Do animals feel for each other, for us? Well, among those with animal companions, women will say, yes. Men might say, well, they need us so they cuddle up when it's cold and they're hungry. But all of us have heard or read extraordinary stories about animals acting altruistically, that is, without regard for themselves first. But where does that impulse come from? Is it intrinsic? Is it automatic? Well, in terms of survival, it is. At least it appears so from studies on animal and human behavior, when survival depends on the help of others in your group. And it seems to be pretty automatic, even felt physically, especially, but not always, when someone else close to us is suffering. So this is helpful, better than the way things appear to be these days. So what's it going to take to maintain our birthright of empathy? First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. The Wildlife Conservation Society has launched an international effort to prevent the extinction of a dozen turtle species. Turtles. I marvel at this. People from around the world collaborating to save creatures because it's the right thing to do. The marvel is that human beings are capable of selflessness, empathy, doing the right thing. We need more of those marvels. Of course, the Wildlife Conservation Society is not unique in this regard. Yet another marvel. It is also not unique in getting itself into moral dilemmas. Last year, the head of the organization in India was forced to resign because he participated in implementation of the Forest Rights Act, environmental legislation common to many developing countries where the traditional rights of tribal people to land are restored. International organizations such as the Wildlife Conservation Society oppose these laws because they believe that tribal peoples will not properly manage wild places. The dilemma was protect the wildlife or protect the tribal people. Some argued that it was a false dilemma, that in fact protecting tribal rights would also protect wildlife. However, although almost all moral dilemmas have questions of fact at their core, I want to bring to your attention how humans actually work out what to do, in particular the critical role of the context in which moral dilemmas arise and are resolved. In the last decade or so, both psychologists and neuroscientists have uncovered what goes on in our brain when we make moral decisions. A typical experiment consists of posing a moral dilemma to someone and identifying what areas of the brain light up when he or she decides what to do. A classic moral dilemma used in these experiments is called the trolley problem. A runaway trolley is headed toward a switch that you control. Along one track, five people are working. Along another, one person is working. You can't stop the train, but only change which track the trolley runs along. If you throw the switch, the trolley kills the single worker, saving the other five. Do you throw the switch? 9 out of 10 people throw the switch. The brain area that lights up is used for calculation. Essentially, those who throw the switch are making a utilitarian decision, one life for five. But if the dilemma is changed, a different area of the brain lights up. This dilemma, again a classic, is called the man-on-the-bridge problem. The trolley is coming, there are five workers on the track, but instead of standing at a switch, you're standing on a bridge over the track. Next to you is a large man who, if thrown in front of the trolley, would bring it to a stop before hitting the five workers. Do you throw the large man in front of the trolley? This time, 9 out of 10 people would not throw the man in front of the train, sacrificing the five to save the one. The brain area that lights up is used not for calculation, but for emotion and empathy. Those who chose to throw the switch justified their action with utilitarian reasoning, greatest good to the greatest number. Those who chose not to throw the large man from the bridge appealed to their gut feeling, their intuition. It just didn't feel right. Researchers frequently use this contrast to suggest that the intuitionists have made a moral choice of poor quality. In other words, the utilitarian credo of greatest good to the greatest number defines good moral choices. That bias is understandable. As Marx observed, utilitarianism is the philosophy of the market, which saturates the air we breathe. It also turns out to have some unsavory associations. The people whose brains light up in resolving moral dilemmas with a utilitarian calculation are those prone to analytic thinking, such as philosophers and scientists, and men, and people who score high for antisocial characteristics on tests for psychopathology and Machiavellianism. But that information doesn't answer the question of whether it's right to throw the switch or the large man. Of course, it would be hard to suggest that it's wrong to throw the switch at all. Or would it? What if the worker who gets killed is your child? Faced with that kind of dilemma, the split is half and half, not 9 out of 10 who would throw the switch. So context is critical, and so is your emotional distance from the subjects of your actions. Consider the following dilemma. A scientific panel has decided that Teflon causes testicular and kidney cancer. You are an executive at DuPont, responsible for Teflon. Do you stop producing Teflon, throwing hundreds of people out of work? Or consider this dilemma. You are a public official. Before you is an application for construction of a cell tower. Most people want the better cell phone reception that is promised. A small number of people fear for their health and the health of their children. Do you vote for or against the application? The moral dilemma is not just about the possible outcomes. It is also about how you create the context in which the dilemma is resolved and how you feel about the people who are affected. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our show, which is on empathy biology, and our guest, Frans de Waal, is a Dutch-born biologist who lives and works in Atlanta, Georgia. He's one of the world's best-known primatologists. Dr. de Waal is a C.H. Candler Professor of Psychology and Director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center at Emory University. He's been elected to the National Academy of Sciences and the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences, and we're going to be discussing two of his many books. He's written many books and magazine articles and edited things. We're going to be talking about Age of Empathy, which is published by Harmony, and Primates and Philosophers, How Morality Evolved, which is published by Princeton University Press. And we're very, very, very happy to have you with us, Dr. de Waal.
I'm glad to be there.
So when I was young, I heard this story that affected me greatly. While on patrol, two white policemen were crossing a bridge when they saw a young Latino getting ready to jump. Just as he launched himself, one of the police ran and grabbed his feet and started to go over with him, except that his partner grabbed him just in time. Why did he do that?
Who did what? You mean the first policeman or the second?
Yeah, the first one. He saw this person who was not in his group. He just saw that he was in trouble, immediately reacted.
Well, I think we do have a tendency that we don't want to see the suffering of others, even if these others don't necessarily belong to our group. There's actually a Chinese philosopher who already 2,000 years ago said we are born to be aversive to the suffering of others. And Adam Smith, the founder of, the father of economics, he already said that we automatically are aversive to seeing others suffer. So I think that idea that we can't stand seeing the suffering of others, even if this sometimes our enemies or our different groups, I think that's a very old piece of knowledge about the human species.
And is it the seeing the suffering of others that is the key in this, that if you actually witness it rather than if you read about it? Because, we note that the media loves to report on the suffering of others, and people constantly stop and stare at the suffering of others. So we have this fascination with the suffering of others, but we don't always respond that way.
No, we don't always respond, and that's actually one of the most interesting things of empathy, I think, is that it's an automatically activated thing, but it does not always work the same way, and it does not always lead to actions. So sometimes people are empathic, but they don't do anything. Sometimes people are not empathic. And so the way the mechanism is turned on and off is, to me, very interesting. In the primates, it's definitely the empathy reaction that we see, and also in other animals, because people are studying it now outside of the primates. It's very much in-group bias. So empathy is much more developed towards members of your own group, or individuals that you know, and especially individuals that you're close to, than towards others. That's for sure. That's a big regulator. And so if you had to choose between saving the life of someone you know or someone you don't know, that choice is usually very simple.
So what I understood from your book was something that made that story resonate very powerfully for me, which is that it is hardwired, that It is in us to do that, to just move and go save somebody if they're in, you know, the people who lurch forward at their own peril to save a child from getting hit by a car, or any of these stories that we hear people running into rescue people from fires, also animals doing this as well. So you have actually set out to study this thing that humans have been observing in each other and in animals and animal companions. How do you set up studies to find the origins of empathy? What are you looking for?
Well, maybe I should just start where I started.
Yes.
The first time I got interested in this topic was I had been documenting what happens after fights in chimpanzees, and so chimpanzees, first of all, they reconcile after fights. So the two opponents, they approach each other, they're usually very hesitant, and then they embrace and they kiss, and sometimes then they groom, and I call that a reconciliation. But in the context of reconciliation, which became a big topic and was studied in many other species, but within that context, I found that the apes also have what I call consolation. Is that someone who has been defeated in a fight and sits in a corner licking its injuries or whatever happens is often approached by other parties who then embrace that individual or kiss or groom or inspect the injuries or lick the injuries. And so there's a lot of positive behavior directed towards individuals who are distressed. And I got very interested in that and documented it, and other people started documenting it in other primates. And then one day I presented this at a meeting of child psychologists, and the child psychologists were giving talks about very similar behavior in children. So they would do, for example, experiments where you instruct a family member, let's say the mother of the house, you instruct her to cry and sob and say that she has so much pain, and then they would measure how do young children react to that situation, and they found that very young children already approach this person then and put their hands on it and ask what's going on and things like that. And they said, well, we call that sympathetic concern. It's a form of empathy. And so I thought, well, that's exactly what my chimps do all the time. And so that's where the connection came with empathy. And from then on, we have studied it. We have both studied spontaneous expressions of empathy, which are very common in many primates, and we study it experimentally. And so one of the things we do experimentally is that we, for example, look at yawn contagion. So humans yawn when they see others yawn.
Yawning, yes.
Yeah, and yawning is... yawn contagion is considered a form of very simple empathy. But it has now been shown in chimpanzees, and it has been shown in dogs. Interestingly enough, in human children, it's absent in autistic children. So autistic children are often said to have an empathy deficit, and one of the expressions is that they have no yawn contagion. So this is an experimental way that you can study it. You can see if someone, for humans, for example, you can see if someone is highly empathic by just seeing, do they frown when they see someone frowning? Do they yawn when they see someone yawning? Do you mimic the movements of those that you see around you, for example?
Clearly we do, and it's very interesting to note that when people are getting close to each other that they do that. Let me just ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're on the phone with Franz Deval. It's spelled Franz, F-R-A-N-S, and then D-E, and then W-A-A-L. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he is the author of The Age of Empathy and he's involved in the book Primates and Philosophers, which is where he writes about his studies and beliefs, and then is challenged by some philosophers, and then he concludes with his own rebuttal or response to them. The interesting thing also is that you, in order to do this, you kind of looked at, I mean, there's this thing of people mirroring their own behaviors. It's clear that we're mimetic of each other and that we fall into step with each other, and animals do this as well. Horses do this, other animals too. But there were some things that you felt that you needed to sort of iron out before you went on to discover which animals were the most empathetic and how they were empathetic, and that was whether or not they had a sense of themselves. And mm-hmm. I thought that the mirror studies were very interesting, although I found myself wondering whether animals, you know, we don't know whether they actually think differently about these things. You know, like I, anyway, but why don't you just discuss some of the actual studies that you set up, like the mirror study, and why that was important.
Yeah, so in human development, in the development of a child, the more complex forms of empathy, they come up at the same time that a child starts to recognize itself in the mirror. And that's by the age of two. By the age of two, children, they talk about themselves. They say, look at me, mama, and I have this, and I have done that. And they start to have a sense of self, which they project into the world. And they also start to recognize themselves in the mirror. And all these things come up at the same time. And that's also the time where when they're confronted with, let's say, another child that is crying, they're not just only distressed themselves, but they become interested in that individual. So as if they can separate their own distress, which is triggered by the other person, and the other's distress. And so it's the self-other distinction. That's how it's usually called in child development. The self-other distinction comes up when a child is two, and that allows us to be not just to respond to the emotions of others, but to try to figure them out and try to do something about it and become more complexly altruistic, so to speak. And for the same reason, some primatologists have speculated long ago that animals who can recognize themselves in the mirror, and there's very few animals who can, they probably have more complex forms of empathy because they have that self-other distinction. And so they started testing primates, and they found that the great apes, which are just a few species like the gorilla, the chimpanzee, and so on, that the great apes recognize themselves in mirrors, but monkeys don't. Monkeys, there's has never been a good report of monkeys recognizing themselves. So it's only the apes who recognize themselves and humans. And so this was the argument that those animals probably have more complex forms of empathy. And the same speculations from long ago, they said, well, if you think of other animals who have complex forms of empathy and altruism, you immediately think of dolphins and elephants because there are so many stories of altruism in those animals. And so you would expect them to recognize themselves also in the mirror. And no one had tested them. The dolphins were tested only like, I think that's 8 years ago, and dolphins passed the self-recognition test. What you do with dolphins, it's a bit more difficult than with humans, but what you do is you put a mark on them and then you put them in front of a mirror and see if they notice that there's something different about themselves. And the dolphins, what they would do is they would be marked far away from a mirror and in some aquarium in New York, and then they would race to the mirror and turn around and look at themselves, and they would spend a lot more time in front of the mirror if they had been marked with some visual mark than mm-hmm. if they had not been marked.
Yeah, there were some animals that actually preened in the mirror. That, you know, like the baboons checked out their back ends. And
yeah, the apes, you know, like, the ape females, they will check out their behind because
right.
that's a very important part of their
right,
body.
Right. Right.
And they want to see how that looks from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then we tested elephants at the Bronx Zoo, and we found an elephant who passed the mirror test. And so that was very remarkable because that fit that whole idea that the self-other distinction allows more complex forms of empathy, and that's why elephants and dolphins and apes have this. And they have this self-recognition, but they also have these complex forms. And so perspective taking, as we usually call it, taking the perspective of somebody else, looking at the world from the eyes of the other, so to speak, that kind of complex form of empathy is probably only present in those very few species who who have that level of self-awareness.
Yeah, although we see it in, for instance, prairie dogs. There was a wonderful, I think it was Nature, which usually is a wonderful program that in the middle of it you have to turn off because they're showing animals killing each other and you kind of have to, you know, it's like Nature, isn't it cute? It's also cruel. But one of their programs was about, I believe it was Nature, was about animals and emotions. And one of the things they showed was prairie dogs who are very alert and looking for danger and don't like to be out of their holes for very long. One of them got hurt by a snake, I believe, and was injured. And they needed to go. I mean, it was time for them to move on. And the other prairie dog started to move on, and they were very alert and worried about predators. And the other one was injured, and they didn't leave him. They all surrounded him, and they groomed him, and they held him, and they stayed with him, and he did pass away. It was very sad, but they wouldn't leave. They wouldn't leave their friend. And so you see this in other animals. You tell wonderful stories about dogs and loyalty, and we know all sorts of stories about, and cats will do this, you know, cuddle up with people. So I have to say, and maybe it's because I'm female, so I'm more empathetic according to your book, which I would believe actually, or that it suits me to be so because of my hormonal balance, but I sense empathy in animals that wouldn't pass the mirror test. So I wonder if it just operates.
Yeah, no, let me make a distinction here. Mm. Empathy is probably found in all the mammals. It has been demonstrated in mice, for example. A laboratory in Montreal has shown that mice become more sensitive to pain if they have seen somebody else, another mouse, in pain. So I think empathy you're going to find in all the mammals. And attachment, which is basically what you described for the prairie dogs, attachment is going to be found in all the mammals. But perspective taking requires that you understand the situation of the other. So it's not just that you're attached to the other or lick the injuries of the other, but you are also interested in the situation of the other and you provide. Let me give you an example, and the example is clearly not something that would happen among prairie dogs. So this is in chimpanzees. This happened at a zoo in Sweden, where a young chimpanzee, a juvenile, had gotten a rope around its neck.
Oh, yeah.
And so the juvenile was choking and would die until the highest-ranking male of the group came over and picked up the juvenile, so took the pressure off the rope and unwrapped very carefully with his other hand the rope and then put down the juvenile. It's a very simple action. It was done very quickly, but it showed a very high level of intelligence because, of course, the normal impulse would be to pull at the juvenile, and that would have been a good way of killing it.
Yep.
So he did the right thing, and in order to do what he did, he needed to understand the specific problem the juvenile was in, and he needed to have some experience with ropes, obviously. And so that's the sort of reaction that I mean by perspective taking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what you're going to find in the prairie dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think there's a distinction, is that empathy is present in all the mammals and maybe also in birds. There's some evidence for that.
Mm-hmm.
But that the higher levels, the ones where you try to understand what's going on with somebody else, are not necessarily found in all of them.
Now clearly, forgive me if I interrupted you. Well, clearly something interferes with empathy what it appears to most people, and you show that this may be a myth, is that human animal males are warlike, and actually you say not so much. So why don't you talk a little bit about what trumps that sympathy-empathy reaction that we have that's visceral?
Well, let me first say something about males and females. Is that I think the origin, and I'm actually not the only one, Dan Batson, who works on altruism in humans, he thinks the same thing, is that the origin of these responses is actually in maternal care. And that's also why these responses remain sensitive to oxytocin, which is a maternal hormone, which is activated when you lactate and when you give birth and things like that. And so you can spray oxytocin into the noses of adult people, both males and females, and it changes their perception of the world and it changes their level of empathy with others. And so we think that the origin of empathy is maternal care. And in mammals, all the mammals, the females have to pay attention to the offspring. If the offspring are distressed or hungry or cold or in danger, they need to come into action. And so they are sensitive to the emotions of others. And that has an enormous survival value for themselves and their offspring. And for males, these tendencies are sort of secondary because they started in the females and then they expanded from there to other relationships, not just mother-offspring relationships. And so that's why the empathy response is stronger in the female. And that's also why, for example, in humans, already on day one, it has been tested. If you look at babies, babies cry when they hear other babies cry, which is their first empathy response. And this is more developed in girl babies than in boy babies already. And so I think empathy is vastly different in the female than in the male, even though males are perfectly capable of it. And if you test males, human males, on stimuli like their own children or their wife or their best friends, you will get lots of good empathy responses. And that's why some of the psychologists, they claim there is no sex difference, but that's, I think, because they have been testing males with stimuli that work the best for them. But if you test males with their enemies, then all of a sudden the empathy is gone. And this has been done in a laboratory where they tested people in a scanner. They put people in a brain scanner. And if you have been mistreated by some experimenter, if you're a female, you still have some small level of empathy. They test that by sticking a needle in this person and see if your pain responses in your own brain lighten up. And women still have some empathy response under those circumstances. But in men, it's very interesting, the pleasure centers lighten up when they see the other guy in pain. Because they see that as a competitor and they want to inflict pain or justice on the competitor. Mm-hmm. And so men have a very different response as soon as it comes to competitive situations.
So what trumps empathy in men? I mean, you're just saying a competitive situation, but, you know, you talk in the book and you give wonderful examples of the fact that human men don't want to kill. And I remember a story that was done on that I heard about an elderly man who had survived World War II who was in the field and had to kill a young German soldier. And he said he kept warning him to stay back, to stop. And he said he looked at him and he was so beautiful. He was blonde and he had beautiful blue eyes. He was like an angel, he said. But then he was getting ready to shoot him, so he shot him. And this is a man who is quite elderly, probably in his late 80s, 90s. And to this day, he still sees this soldier in his dreams and cries for him.
Well, that's the problem, is that we instruct people. Warfare is often presented as a form of aggression, but I think it has very little to do with aggression.
Right.
Yes, the leaders who go to war, they are probably in an aggressive mood when that happens. But the soldiers themselves in the field, they have just been ordered around to go somewhere and to kill somebody. And so that's a very unnatural situation to kill. If I'm very angry at you for a very good reason, I may have enough anger to kill you. That's a more natural context because all my hormones and physiology is then geared up for killing. But if I have to kill somebody just because somebody else tells me, that's not a natural situation. And that's what we put people in. And yes, post-traumatic stress disorder is largely, in my opinion, the effect of the fact that we cannot turn down empathy completely. We are incapable, and also many men are incapable, of turning it to zero. There's always something that remains, and that means that there's going to be an enormous conflict if you have to kill somebody that you can actually look into the eyes.
So part of what trumps empathy is hierarchy.
Yeah, because that's what we do. We have to instruct soldiers to kill, and there's a very interesting book. It's called On Killing, by David Grossman, which explains how few people actually kill during war. It's only 1 or 2% actually of the soldiers who do most of the killing, and who probably have no problem with that, but most of them do have problems with it.
We're going to need to take a brief musical break. We're on the phone with author and primatologist Franz De Waal. His books are The Age of Empathy and Primates and Philosophers. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. Please stay with us. We'll be back after this brief musical break. Welcome back. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Get a free stream of this week's show. Find out about our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. And there's lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please do it by email at admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. We're doing an interview today with Franz Duval, author of Age of Empathy and Primates and Philosophers. Dr. Duval, did you have a website that you wanted to give people to look at?
Well, we have the Living Links website that you can look at, which is www.emory.edu. EDU and then /livinglinks, all capitalized with a lower hyphen between them.
Okay, but anyway, we'll link to it on our website.
Yeah.
So is better socioeconomic status good or bad for empathy in humans?
Well, I'm not sure we know that. I'm not sure we know.
What do you think based on the animal studies?
Well, I do think that the decision, what you do with your empathy, is to some degree a rational, selfish decision. Let's say I walk the street and I don't want to take the time to be stopped by a beggar, then I walk on the other side of the street and try to avoid some. So we take all these decisions where we turn off empathy or we avoid situations in which it might be aroused or. Let's say you go to the movies and something horrible happens in the movie. You slam your hands over your eyes because you don't want to see it, which means you regulate, in this case, your empathy response by turning off the stimulus. So we have all these ways of regulating things. And I think that's actually a very interesting area. It's like, how do we arrive at the decisions to help, yes or no? And if you have more resources, you can afford more help, of course, of others.
One of the things that you really advocate for in your argument in Age of Empathy is that these tendencies that human animals have, and we are in fact animals, to your mind, I believe this is so, people can believe what they will, are ingrained. They go back for millenniums, that they go back to the origins of mammals and whatnot. So these are very old feelings and tendencies. And one of them is rooting for the underdog and liking fairness.
Uh-huh.
And you've seen this in animals in ways that was very moving. And it seems to be so in humans for the most part.
Yeah, we do experiments on monkeys where we present them with the same rewards for the same task. And if you do that, they are perfectly fine with that. But then if you reward one of them with something that's much better, let's say one monkey still gets pieces of cucumber, which is very poor quality food, for a task, and the other monkey now gets grapes for the same task.
No.
And the grapes are so much better. Then the one who works for the cucumber is not happy anymore. So before that time, he was perfectly happy, and the cucumber was fine, and he would eat it all the time and so on. But now that the other guy is getting grapes, they start rejecting the food. They even throw their food away, which is a very strange response, but very recognizable for humans. And I think actually what's happening in Wall Street at the moment, you know, our reaction to Wall Street is exactly that, is that we are living in cucumber land and they live in grape land, and all of a sudden now that the economy is not so good anymore, we pay attention to that.
Well, and what did the animals favored equalizing things a little bit. Here in our modern society where, as you say, you know, the television is blasting ads for grapes and people are eating cucumber, how does this affect our innate capacity for sympathy? How does capitalism, for instance, affect our innate capacity for sympathy and empathy? Do you think? This is your opinion.
Well, yeah, I think capitalism by itself, there's nothing bad about capitalism, in my opinion, because it makes use of our desire for incentives, and actually without the incentives, we might not be doing very much. So I'm personally not opposed to capitalism. But I do have a problem with huge inequalities. And inequality is something that the primates are very sensitive for, too, and I think that humans are very sensitive to. And so, for example, I heard the introduction to this show, which talked about inequality and healthcare, and it is well known that the countries that have the highest levels of inequality, they also have the highest level of violence and the lowest level of longevity. So, for example, the U.S., the longevity in the U.S. is not particularly good, and one of the reasons that that's the case, we think, is that the inequality is very high in the United States.
Again, in your opinion, and from what you've observed in our heritage from the animals, what effect do you think our age of information, where people are plugged in and texting and on the phones and not interacting in the flesh so much with others, what effect might that have on our feeling for fairness and empathy? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm personally not, of course, I'm an expert of primates. I'm not someone who looks at how monkeys use the internet or something like that. But
they would, I'm sure, if they could.
I think the disruption of direct visual access between individuals, that's a very problematic. So, for example, if you look at warfare, we talked about warfare. If you sit in a bomber or you sit in a place where you can send a missile to a very distant place, it's much easier to kill somebody at a distance than to kill somebody standing right in front of you. And so by removing these let's say, these physical contacts that we have or the body contacts that we have with others, you get all sorts of strange phenomena. You see that on the internet in the discussions on the blogs. You see people reacting in a very nasty manner that they probably would not have if they were right in front in the same room as the same person. But on an anonymous blog, we do these things. And so, yes, I think it actually reduces body interaction, and body interaction is the basis of a lot of our empathy. And so if you talk with somebody who's sad and who sits in front of you, you adopt a sad posture. Or if someone is happy and jumpy and laughing, you also are laughing. And so the empathy initially ran via our bodies, and on the internet, of course, all of that is sort of removed.
You know, another thing that puzzles me, too, is that people can play very violent video games and they can watch extremely violent movies. Some people can, I can't. And people rubberneck when they're on the road and someone's had an accident. So, and then the news, which I assume that if it bleeds, it leads, is because that's what they think. I mean, that must be getting ratings for them, you know. Mm-hmm. I can't bear this stuff, but I wonder whether that's true in animals. I don't observe that in animals, that they're fascinated by, I can't say the German word correctly, but...
Schadenfreude.
Yes, thank you. Jeffrey, who studied German, I can say it probably
Well, Schadenfreude is like, that's like the opposite of empathy, because
yes,
Schadenfreude
exactly.
is where you get a kick out of the
yes.
misery of somebody else.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, there are stories on that in the primates, is that... I do think once you get a more developed form of empathy, you also get that you can take pleasure in the pain of others. Now, the interesting thing is that empathy by itself is a neutral characteristic. Empathy is not necessarily positive. Empathy just means that you are sensitive to the emotions of others, you adopt some of these emotions, and you understand some of the emotions. That can be used for good reasons and for bad reasons. So, someone who tortures, the torturer, also needs empathy. The torturer needs to know what is painful for somebody else, and that's why he is capable of torturing. And so empathy by itself does not always lead to positive outcomes, and I do think that our capacity for Schadenfreude is partly because we are an empathic species, and we do understand what happens to others.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We are interviewing by phone Franz Duval, Age of Empathy and Primates and Philosophers are two of his many books and writings. So there are some stunning... Well, I should go back for a moment and just say that I have interviewed Robert Sapolsky numerous times,
uh-huh.
and
of
he
course.
Talks...
He's local
yes,
for you.
Yes, yes, and he's very funny. So he's very much fun to interview. And he makes, you know, he comes up with ideas about what all of this animal studies means for us as humans. And he talks a lot about, particularly baboons, how much they like to torture each other. They seem to like to do that. But there are some very moving, I'd like you to retell some of the moving stories from the book. Like, for instance, there's an amazing story. You talk about the elephants, and we're all glazing over while we're reading this about how, you know, I was like, I want one. Now I want an elephant, which is, of course, not very realistic. And you talk about how incredibly dangerous they are because they're so silent on those huge, soft feet. Mm-hmm. And there was one story about an elephant who felt endangered by or felt her children or something was endangered, so she hurt somebody, and then what happened? She actually broke someone's leg, and then what happened?
This was an elephant. This was an African elephant. There's actually very few stories of elephants doing much for humans, because that's very different from dolphins. The dolphins are well known to rescue swimmers, to defend them against sharks and things like that. But elephants usually are not particularly excited about humans and sometimes hostile to them. This was an elephant who had broken a herder's, in Africa, had broken his leg. And instead of then going on, the elephant had stayed with this person to protect him and to provide him with shade, standing in the sun over him, smelling him, protecting him against buffalo. And so for more than 24 hours, the elephant hung around the person that she had injured. And then when humans came to pick up the herder, she even defended him at that point. And then let them take him. So, elephants may show these responses to humans. But, of course, for elephants, we have lots of good stories of what they do for each other. They may try to lift each other up. Or when a poacher has hit one of them, they react to that. And so elephants are very protective of their own kind and very protective, of course, of their young, because the reason probably elephants live in these close-knit herds is probably to protect the young mainly. The adult elephant has little to fear in life from predators, but the young ones certainly are vulnerable.
There's also a very moving story about a dog. There are numerous stories about dogs and loyalty, but there's a wonderful. There's a couple of where the dogs won't leave after. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell one of those stories? I'm thinking of the train station.
The dogs are attached, and so these are stories of loyalty. And there's actually a statue in Tokyo that I've seen close to a station where there was a dog who. Normally would come to pick up his owner, and his owner would always arrive at the same time. You know how the Japanese trains are, always at 5 o'clock or whatever the time was, the dog would come to the station to pick up his master, and then one day the master died and didn't show up anymore. And the dog still came, I believe for 11 years, came to at exactly that same time to that same place in the station every day.
And people fed him.
Yeah, people were very impressed by the loyalty of the dog, mm-hmm. obviously, and mm-hmm. then they put a little statue outside, and they even named the exit of the station after the dog.
One of the things that comes up in the book, Primates and Philosophers, is the issue of animal rights.
Mm-hmm.
And you had your own very distinct opinion about all of this. Do you want to speak to that a bit? Because I know there are people listening who are concerned about animal studies and animal rights.
Yeah, the animal rights study came up there because Peter Singer, of course, was one of the commentators, and so we got into a debate about what that means, animal rights, and he feels that animal rights have to do with the level of sentience or the level of conscience or whatever we call it that animals achieve. So that animals who have a higher level of that, they may even have more rights than humans who have a lower level of that. That's his extreme opinion, and that's not necessarily my opinion. Because I argue in the book that loyalty is part of morality, is that I have more obligations towards my own children than I have to towards somebody else's children. And this is translated in our moral rules to some degree. And I think loyalty also applies to your species. You have more loyalty with your own species than with somebody else's species. And so we got into this debate about what is the role of loyalty or what is the role of sentience that you achieve.
The other thing that I really enjoyed reading in your book was there was a section where you were discussing various things and you said, and I quote, "The worst part of someone's personality is often always the best." And I really believe that so clearly, so strongly. But why don't you explain what you meant by that? I love that.
Well, yeah, that was more like a tongue-in-cheek remark about human relations, because, of course, I noticed in your daily life is that if you like somebody, you usually also like the negative parts. But some other people will consider the negative parts about that person. So if someone is, let's say, very loud-mouthed and very lively person, that's a negative characteristic under some circumstances, but under other circumstances, that also makes them more interesting to you, and you laugh a lot with them and so on. And so, yes, I think often with people that we like, that's the feeling, is that you like everything about them, not just the friendly, nice aspects of their personality. And I think that's also true in many of our relations with animals, I think, is that chimpanzees, for example, can be very aggressive and dominance-oriented and territorial and so on, which makes them maybe, in the eyes of some, not a very sympathetic species. But it also makes them a very interesting species, because it makes them very similar in their power games to human politicians, for example. And so it makes for very interesting comparisons, and we recognize a lot of what they do, and part of that is what we normally would consider negative behavior.
The other thing that I thought of when you said that, or the place that I went to, is that, for instance, people who are loudmouths often get things done. You know, the mm-hmm. stuff gets done, and they can be leaders and stuff. So people will criticize them, but they actually get stuff done. And then the softer, more receptive people are nurturing. And, you know, so there's this balance that we have mm-hmm. with people. And that's where I went, is that we sometimes reject the parts of ourselves that are very intrinsic, even maybe empathy. And yet they are intrinsic, and they're a balance point to our sort of inherited trait of being in community with each other, needing to cooperate with each other. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We're interviewing Franz de Waal, Age of Empathy and Primates and Philosophers. He is a primatologist. We're talking about the biology of empathy. I'm wondering if you think that hierarchy is inevitable and necessary among those of us, those animals that are.
It's an interesting question, because, you know, I'm a biologist who lives in a psychology department, and so I always, when I get these social psychology textbooks that people try to give me, I look up at the end what they say about dominance and power, and they almost never say anything. It's like in psychology, power is a taboo term, and power can only be used as, in the context of power abuse. Whereas I live in primatology, of course, most of the time, where dominance and power, we deal with it every day, because every group of primates that you look at, whether it's baboons or chimpanzees or whatever, there is a power structure. There has to be a power structure. They could not live otherwise. And the same is true for humans. I still remember speaking with a psychology student who had seen two-year-old children getting together for the first time at some daycare center. On the first day, and they had videotaped it, and they were beating up on each other. They were establishing what we primatologists would say, they were establishing their dominance order, which they need to do on the first day, and after that things will calm down, but then at least they know who is the dominant among them. And so we are very used to this, but people get sometimes very upset, and this student was very upset that children would do this kind of stuff to each other, even though all animals do it to each other. And so I personally think that dominance and power, the vertical structure of society, is absolutely essential. We cannot do without it, and other primates cannot do without it. That's not a statement of whether I approve of it or not, because that's for me not the point. The point is that we have these tendencies, and they will come out regardless. And so a society without hierarchy is, for me, unthinkable. It would not exist. And I would hope that the social sciences, such as psychology, one day wake up and see that they should not close their eyes to a major dimension of social life and act as if it doesn't exist, because it's present everywhere.
Yeah, my own opinion of the dominance rituals and the hierarchical activity among children is experimental, mm-hmm. because my observation is, from having been a child, that sometimes the bullies are actually the most frightened children, and that the ones that they bully often grow into be to leaders, turn into leaders later.
But you should not equate those two. Is that there's two kinds of dominance in human children. So the bullies, they are aggressive, and others are afraid of them, which is one way of being dominant. And the bullies are almost always males, although I think among females you also have them.
There are some, yes.
And then the second kind of dominance, and that's more equally divided between males and females, is the one whose example the other children follow, and who say, we're going to play this game, and then everyone is going to play that game. And so those are more sort of leadership qualities. And so those are two very different ways of being dominant. In primate groups, almost always, I would say, you end up with leadership type of dominance. It's rare. I have seen them. Sometimes you have bullies who beat up everybody, and everyone is afraid of them. And they usually end very poorly, because once there is going to be a young male who overthrows them, and they're not very, no one is really sympathetic to them, and they get expelled or killed, or something bad happens to them. Whereas the leaders, and that's the more typical dominant that you have in primate groups, is usually a high-ranking male who is not overly aggressive and doesn't establish his dominance necessarily by beating up everybody. And the others are not afraid of him necessarily, but they respect his decisions. And so that's the kind of dominance that when he is replaced by a younger male, which always happens at some point, he will drop to position two or position four or whatever. He's kept in the group, and he leads a long and productive life afterwards because he's not hated by everybody.
Thank you for that. I like the way you explained that. The other interesting thing is the effect of hierarchy on empathy. One thing I observed from reading The Age of Empathy is that some of the alpha males are actually the most empathetic. They're the ones, like the story about the one that went and saved the little baby ape who was hanging himself and knew what to do. So they're also often the ones that have the most ability to empathize and do something about something when someone's in trouble.
Yeah, that's important to point out, because people often think that a hierarchy in primates is a brutal affair in which the dominant beats up number two and number two beats up number three and whatever. And this may be true, for example, in the baboons of Sapolsky, this may be true for the male. I'm not sure it's true for the females necessarily, but this may be true for the male baboons. And so sometimes the hierarchy is a brutal affair, but most of the time in a well-integrated group of, let's say, chimpanzees, the dominant also has a protective function. He breaks up fights between others. Mm-hmm. And so he can become very popular among the lower classes of the society, so to speak, because he protects them against aggressive newcomers or young males who become overly aggressive. And so the dominance order is not always an order of brutality. Since the dominant male needs the support of the group to remain the dominant male, usually, there's good reasons for him actually to share food with everybody and to protect the others, and they do all these kind of things.
Going back to Sapolsky's research, he notes also that in terms of preserving your health, there's a group of baboons that opt out of the hierarchy and hang out with the girls and get groomed a lot and have more sex, and they live pretty long.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question that you bring up in the book, which is, if you were God, would you change anything about humans?
Yeah, and so people have asked me that, and I'm very reluctant to say we should change this or that. So, for example, you might think it would be good to remove aggression from human society. Well, I'm not sure. I think the excessive forms, yes, obviously. But do you really want a society in which, for example, businessmen, the entrepreneurs, they have aggression. Many people in the arts, you need to have some, you know, some level of aggression to perform in the art or in sport or people who the rock singers need some level of testosterone to sing interesting songs, you know.
Even the girls. Even the women.
Removing aggression entirely from society would probably be a bad thing. Or people would say increase empathy. Now, empathy you need to use with discrimination. You cannot be empathic towards everything and everything around you. You need to have limits, and you need to have a filter, and you need to react sometimes and not all the time, because otherwise you will probably become depressed. Actually, one of the theories about the high levels of depression among women is that women are more empathic, and so they are more affected by the misery of a lot of people around them. And so empathy, increasing empathy, is not necessarily something that I would recommend. And so, for example, the oxytocin that I mentioned increases trust. Now,
trust, huh?
Yeah. So the marketers have already latched onto that research, and they say, well, maybe we should, if people walk into our showroom with cars, we should maybe give them some oxytocin so that they trust the car salespeople more. You know. Well, is that a good thing? Do we want to increase trust randomly so that you use it, you know, you increase it for everybody and everything? That would be a dangerous thing to do. And so, if I were God, I would probably not mess too much with human nature, personally.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that our emotional world is partially protective. It keeps us going, and it helps us to make good decisions based on past experience.
Yeah, so nature, evolution has worked for millions and millions of years on the balance of our physiology and brain and capacities. And I would not want a politician to decide that all of a sudden we're going to be more empathic or something like that.
Very briefly, who do you like hanging out with? I mean, aside from your family and your wife, do you prefer to be with your animal friends or your human friends?
Oh, I'm of course, I spend an enormous amount of time with animals, and I could not conceive myself not living somehow with animals. But I'm usually not looking at it as a choice, like I have to choose between animals and my wife or something like that.
No, I wouldn't make you choose there. I just meant, do you prefer the company of animals to sort of humans in general?
I like both.
Yeah,
like
good
both.
For you. You would do, I think, if you were going to do this much research. But I envy you the time that you're spending with these animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's very lovely. Well, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us today. We've been speaking with Franz Deval. It's Deval, The Age of Empathy and Primates and Philosophers, How Morality Evolved. These books are both available now. The Age of Empathy is a Harmony book, and The Primates and Philosophers is Princeton University Press. So, again, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Get a free stream of this week's show, information about our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.